Oh, the sun god. Agnihi, the fire. Come, the sky. Barut, the air. Devaha, the demigods. Somaha, the moon. Sunja, evening. Ahane, the day and night. Tishaha, the directions. Come, the water. Kuhu, the land. Swayam, personally. Narmaha, Yamaraj, or the super soul. Iti, thus. He, indeed. Ete, all of these. Dhyasya, of a living entity embodied in the material elements. Sakshinaha, witnesses. So translation. The sun, fire, sky, air, demigods, moon, evening, day, night, directions, water, land, and super soul himself all witness the activities of the living entity. So you can repeat. The sun, fire, sky.
The sun, fire, sky.
Air, demigods, moon.
Air, demigods,
moon. Evening, day, night.
Evening, day, night.
Directions, water, land. And super soul himself all witness the activities of the living entity. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The members of some religious sects, especially Christians, do not believe in the reactions of karma. We once had a discussion with a learned Christian professor who argued that although people are generally punished after the witnesses of their misdeeds are examined, were the witnesses responsible for one suffering the reactions of past karma? To such a person, the answer by the Yamadutas is given here. A conditioned soul thinks that he is working stealthily and that no one can see his sinful activities, but we can understand from the Shastras that there are many witnesses, including the sun, fire, sky, air, moon, demigods, evening, day, night, directions, water, land, and the super soul himself, who sits with the individual soul within his heart. Where is the dearth of witnesses? The witnesses and the Supreme Lord both exist, and therefore so many living entities are elevated to higher planetary systems or degraded to lower planetary systems, including the hellish planets. There are no discrepancies, for everything is arranged perfectly by the management of the Supreme God. So bhavati yana bala kriya cha. The witnesses mentioned in this verse are also mentioned in other Vedic literatures. Uticca chandra vinilo nalascha yar bhumirapo hridayam yamascha ahascha ratrishcha ube cha sanje Dharmopi janati narasya vrittam. Okay. So, suravnir kamaru deva tsoma sanja nidashaha kam guswayam narmahite yete dvayasya sakshinaha. So, omagana tivananda shah. Jananjana shlakaya chakshur unmeditam yena tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So there's several interesting points here in this verse before we get on to the main topic about the living entities that are being witnessed. We can understand implicitly by reading this verse that the sun, fire, sky, air, demigods, moon, evening, day, night, directions, water, land, and of course super soul, all are conscious. Now this is really something for our Western psychology, our Western understanding to sort of like grasp. Isn't it? I mean, the sun is conscious, the moon is conscious, the wind is conscious. Phew. and demigods. You know, demigods we can pretty much accept if we accept demigods. And then evening is conscious, day is conscious, night is conscious. How is it possible that all of these different aspects of the material creation are conscious? Well, one explanation is that there are controllers of each of the different aspects. I mean, for example, you may, let's say electricity, for example. That's an energy coming out. So, you, in one sense, you could say the electricity has consciousness. Not in the sense that, you know, there's super soul in every single one of the, electrons, but that's a different thing. But, in the sense that if something happens with the electricity, they're aware of it in the powerhouse. Even if, I mean, for example, there was a recent storm and then so many shorts in the electricity. And I'm sure in the powerhouse they were watching all their dials or screens nowadays. Of course, nowadays they don't have dials anymore. That's in the old days. You know, they had these dials that registered the voltage. But now it's just like screens that register. And they're aware of how much energy a certain area in Hillsboro is using. And at certain times of the day, they have to up their energy because, you know, more people, was it just in India, at a certain time of the day, everybody turns on their microwaves. And it sort of uses a lot of energy. In other words, they're aware. Of course, it's not like perfectly aware. They're not aware that we've plugged in a computer here. But they're aware that a certain amount of energy is being utilized in a certain area, and then the meter reader comes around and he says, you've used a certain amount of kilowatt hours this particular month, or units this particular month. So there's some awareness. It's not a complete awareness, of course. But we can compare it to the demigods. You know, the demigods are controlling different aspects of the material energy, and they're aware of what's happening with these different aspects. And they're aware of the interactions that these different aspects are having with the living entities. I mean, the demigods are quite powerful persons. Because it's not like the person in charge of the electrical powerhouse. He's not powerful, but he's using the mechanisms that are coming with the powerhouse with his job to sort of have more power than he ordinarily has. I mean, it's something like one of Gopal's favorite characters, that he puts on a suit. What's the name of that character? Iron Man. And even though he's not powerful, right? I got the name right? So he puts, even though he's not powerful in and of himself, he becomes empowered by the certain mechanism that he comes in contact with, that he's developed or whatever. So the Jiva soul, of course, is 1/10,000 the tip of the hair. There's actually some discussion about that. This is interesting. I was thinking about this the other day, that, you know, what is 1/10,000th the tip of the hair? 1/10,000th the tip of the hair basically means no material dimension. Because if, I was listening to some devotees speculating about what it meant. 1/10,000th the tip of the hair. But because I've been trained in mathematics, I know if you go and take the tip of the hair, then you get to a mathematical point that has no dimensions to it. Because that tip means, it doesn't matter how big your hair is, whether you're a tiger or, you know, or me with very little hair on the back of the head. It just, the tip is actually, if you go all the way to the tip, then you get, I mean, anyone who's studied mathematics knows this, isn't it? If you go to the tip of anything, like even the tip of this, if this is not hair, go all the way to the tip, and it goes smaller and smaller, and finally you have what's called a mathematical point. A mathematical point has no dimensions. It's just a theoretical understanding of something in space, but it has no dimensions. No length, no breadth, no weight, no nothing. And that's the soul. The soul actually has no material dimensions. So in other words, the soul, in order to have some power in this world, whether it's the soul takes the position of a demigod, the soul takes the position of a king, then the soul has to be empowered by the Supreme Lord in a certain way. But a king is empowered by the Lord. I mean, we're empowered. We have certain powers that we've been given by Krishna. What do they say? Great power comes great responsibility, Gopal. But what is it, what is the power? Human body is, you know, is extreme empowerment. And human intelligence is extreme empowerment. So, because without that empowerment, we would just, and you realize that as you get older, because you start to lose some of your empowerment. Or lose your hair, you know. Just, you become bald, you know. Anyway, it's, you lose that empowerment. You know, I was empowered to grow hair when I was young. And now I've sort of lost that empowerment. Right, Gopal? So in other words, the soul really doesn't have a tremendous amount of power. Of course, it's, by itself, it's very brilliant, but it needs to be empowered by the Supreme Lord. So these different demigods are empowered by the Lord to have this, nature that they're aware of whatever they come in contact with and whatever the thing that they're controlling comes in contact with. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing, but if, you know, if you just understand it in terms of the mechanistic, have a mechanistic understanding of people who are controlling different, let's say, the internet or something like that. I mean, like for example, I saw a movie about the control of the internet. Not a movie, but like a brief video. And they have these people who monitor the whole internet. And they have these screens they show everywhere in the world that, you know, where people are downloading or uploading. And they can actually trace up, you know, if you're downloading some film that you shouldn't be downloading, bootlegging is called, they can actually trace you, and then the FBI or the CIA or whoever will show up at your door one day. And then you'll be sued by Sony Pictures or...
Yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, some people, like, they download some guy's alone in his house, and he's downloading the latest song by the Beatles. I don't know whoever else is singing nowadays. What? It shows how dated I am, you know. I don't know.
Still the Beatles.
Yeah. Let's say they download some copyrighted song, and then somehow or other they get a notice from the court that they're being sued for like $100,000 for downloading like 10 songs and sharing, isn't it? You know, where did that come from? You know, I'm just here in my home. But, you know, there's people, there's something called the IP address, you can be traced out, right? And they understand that you're doing that. And so then you get arrested, you can get sued, you can lose a lot of money. So you got to be careful when you're downloading films that you're not supposed to download. Anyway, apart from that issue, we can equate that with the demigods, who have far more sophisticated powers than people who are just observing the internet, or people observing the electricity, or whatever, you know, or the satellites, you know, obviously, just like there was a plane lost, recently, some plane, they couldn't figure out what happened with the Malaysian Airlines plane. What happened with it? So the Chinese reconfigured like 20 satellites to try to figure out where it was. And of course they weren't able to so far. I mean, they will be able, ultimately, they'll find it. But Krishna has given the demigods much more power than that, so they can understand all these things. Okay, that's one point. And it's hard for a Western mind to understand these things, that they're demigods, or that they're demigods aware of all these things. I mean, just like I'm breathing, there's Vayu, the wind god, and somehow or other, he or his associates or assistants or servants are aware of what's happening with my breathing process. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? Just like one time Vayu got upset because his son, Hanuman, was injured by Indra, and he stopped everybody's breathing. I mean, can you imagine that? How powerful these demigods are? That you're just like, all of a sudden, just minding your business, you know, on your computer, and you can't breathe anymore. And the whole universe, everything, all the wind stopped, everything stopped in the whole universe, just because this guy got upset. Excuse me, Vayu. Isn't it? I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? So powerful. And then finally, you know, they had to apologize to Vayu, bring Hanuman back to life, give him all these benedictions, that he would be powerful. You know, it was all part of Krishna's plan, obviously. And then Hanuman had a little scar on his jaw, therefore he's called the Jaw. You know, like you see sometimes a wrestler. It's called the jaw.
Yeah.
So Hanuman is like, that's why it's called Hanuman. It means the jaw. The powerful jaw man. Or jaw monkey. A combination. Kim Purusha. There's a new devotee in class, by the way. Tell him to sit down. So, anyway, so that's the point. The demigods are powerful. Like, that's hard to believe it, but, you know, that's life. That's life because God has assistance. Not that God is going to be bothered with everything that's going on. Like we talked about the other day, that he has all these energies, and here are the energies, some of the energies are being described. And these energies are first-class servants of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they actually do everything without God being bothered, without Krishna being bothered about the whole thing. Okay. So that's the first point. The second point actually is much more important, about the super soul witnessing all activities. Now, Prabhupada comments here about, some religious people, who shall remain nameless, don't believe in the law of karma. But the interesting thing is if you don't believe in the law of karma, you don't believe in God. And I'll explain what that means. Because if things are happening just accidentally, you know, accidentally, without karma, that means everything's just happening because of reactions and interactions of the material energy, and everything's just accidental. You were born with a silver spoon in your mouth. You were born without a spoon. You know, whatever. I mean, it's all just accident. You know, bad things happen to good people because they ain't no God. Or, even if there is a God, he's just not powerful, which means he's not God anyway. Like this person, you know, I mentioned many times his name, Harvey Kushner, He wrote a book, you know, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, Good Things Happen to Bad People. And it's interesting that if you chant his name, you chant Hare Krishna too. Hare Krishna. Nice Jewish boy. So, isn't it? Harry, as a Harry, not Hari. So, oh no, he basically explained that God is a nice guy. You know, and he set the universe in motion, but just things got out of control. And, you know, things get out of control. I mean, that happens too. You, with some of us too. You know, I started this temple and things are out of control now.
Yeah.
You know, I can't control everybody. I was told that sometimes devotees don't get along with each other. I can't just like wave my magic wand and say, presto, chainzo, whatever. Get along, you know, love everybody, love each other right now, you know, singing a song from the 1960s. It doesn't work like that. So God is more or less like me. You know, he starts something on a bigger scale, of course, much bigger. You know, the universe is bigger than the Nuka Loka, obviously. And it just got out of control. You know, he's the prime mover, and he just... Or another thing you can posit is that God just doesn't care, which makes him not God either, you know. Because the definition of God is that he's all-powerful, all-knowing, and he's all-good. You know, all the omni stuff, right? And, of course, we have a few extra ones we add in Krishna consciousness. But in the Western world, they don't have those. Like, he's all-beautiful. Yeah, that's it. We add a few more extra ones, you understand? Whereas in the Western world, they just have these three. All-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. And you take away any of those, he's not God. He's someone else. You know, he's a good guy, maybe. Or maybe he's a bad guy. Or maybe the devil overpowered him. You know, the devil's competing with him right now. I mean, this is also something that just a mental speculation that's coming out with the devil thing. I mean, there's no mention of that by Jesus Christ or by any bona fide prophet that there's a devil who made you do it. He's just a convenient excuse. Like, we have our convenient excuse of Maya. Why are you nonsense? I'm in Maya. So that's the Hare Krishna version of the devil. Isn't it? Why can't you get up in the morning? I'm in Maya. And so you ask the Christians, you know, why can't you give up drinking? Well, the devil's making me do it. And then we have a similar thing too, like we just say, well, Prabhupada's going to save me. And they say, Jesus saves me. No man is free of sin. You know, we're all conditioned soul. We're all hopeless, useless, whatever. But I accept Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, of course, we never say Prabhupada died for our sins. But we say, you know, Prabhupada's saving me because I love Prabhupada. I may be smoking marijuana. I may be doing any damn thing, but Prabhupada saves me. He loves Prabhupada. And the same way, you know, I love Jesus. So we have we actually have things that are very similar with the Christians in Krishna consciousness, you know, similar dynamics. We don't use the same names, you change the names, but it's exactly the same thing as far as excuse making. You know, anyway, so the point is if we actually believe in God, then you have to believe in karma. The people are getting a certain reaction because of they did something. They deserve something. Or God is rectifying them in a certain way. You can't get out of that. And if you don't accept that, you don't accept God, which is really an important point. So another point that you derive from this is that if there is a God, and if God spoke or emanated the Vedic literatures, and if God has all these different qualities, such as being omniscient, then the Vedic literatures must be perfect. Because God is perfect, dharmam, tasatcha, bhagavat, pranitam, and religion or dharma comes from God. So the Vedic literatures, so of course this can become a little problematic too. When you say the Vedic, because then you start thinking about which Vedic literatures or which editions of the Vedic literatures that are extant means, have actually come down to cyclic succession too, because there are some, I would say the majority of what we call the Itihasas, Puranas, and other things like that have been meddled with throughout the ages. Not the Bhagavatam, not the Bhagavad Gita, of course, the primary literatures that we have, but many of the other literatures have been, let's say, meddled with means things taken out, things added, or things changed within the literatures. And then also another point is many of the Vedic literatures are dealing with injunctions according to time, places, and circumstances. It's an interesting thing. There was there was an Indian professor at the university, his name was Ramanujan, from South India. And he said the difference between your Western psychology and the one difference between the Indian way of looking at things is that when they give some injunction, it's according to time, place, and circumstance in India. But in the West, we try to make things like absolute for all time, places, and circumstances, which is interesting. So in India, so you see, like Prabhupada, saying different things in different circumstances that appear to the outsider to sometimes be contradictory. You know, it's certain things like for example, he'll say that, you know, household life is a deep well. And once you fall into the well, you don't get out. Don't worry. It doesn't apply to anybody in this room. So, and then other times he'll say, you know, in the Bhagavatam, it'll say, you know, one who has a good wife and everything like that, it'll help one advance in spiritual life and go back to Godhead. So you have to completely, you know, what appears to be contradictory, but it's time, place, and circumstance. Obviously, I mean, just to be a little funny, wells can be good because you can get water from them. But if you jump in them, that's a different thing. So, in other words, if you utilize everything, manasa deha geha yogeshimor arpilam tuya padi nandakashor, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, understanding my mind, my body, my home, my wife, everything belongs to Krishna, then it can be the cause of your liberation. So there's different circumstances where different injunctions or different instructions may be applicable, which is really interesting. You know, so of course we have devotees take things sometimes out of context. Like, you know, Prabhupada sometimes talks about women's intelligence, which I won't talk about right now, because it would be dangerous for me. But anyway, sometimes he talks about women's intelligence. And then at other times, I just heard some statement from Prabhupada where he said, devotee women are more intelligent than devotee men. And then, you know, and then you had this typical thing, the 64, 34 ounces type of thing. And one devotee asked Prabhupada, I think it was Vishaka, asked Prabhupada, after he said, you know, women only have 34 ounces. You know, Prabhupada was actually not stating that as an absolute fact, but then she asked, well, what about devotee women? And Prabhupada said, well, when someone becomes a devotee, their brain grows. It's interesting, isn't it? The brain grows. So many of the statements that, I mean, just talking about some of the statements that Prabhupada made about ladies, are in a Vedic context or in a Varnashram context, which is interesting. Because in the Varnashram context, the Varnashram society is generally agriculturally based. And, I mean, we're in a completely different society now. For example, in modern society, where everybody's in the city, no one's in the farm anymore, that having children is an expensive hobby. You know, because there's some computation that if you have a child, it costs like between $300,000 and $400,000 by the time the person has gone to the university. It's pretty expensive. Whereas in an agricultural, rural society, having a child is an asset. Isn't it? Because you have someone to take care of the farm, or if you're a Brahmin, you have someone to carry on your heritage, someone to go out and viksha, you know, to ask donations from people. So you find, in other words, you find the position of, you know, men and women vastly different in different societies. In context, you know, talking about the contextual situation, vastly different. We're in a completely different society. Of course, Prabhupada did want to institute Varnashram. Ultimately, Prabhupada did want to institute Varnashram because basically the modern society, which is based, actually the underlying philosophy of modern society is that things are getting better. Of course, not nowadays in the postmodern world, people are actually starting to disagree with that. But when the Industrial Revolution first started, you know, just people were amazed at all the different things that could be done, like the locomotive and mass production and everything like that. So then there was this whole idea. This is, of course, in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's days, before Bhaktivinoda Thakur, let's say, manifested his pastimes as a pure devotee, that was the mood. And there was this whole group of people in India called the Bhadra Loka. Bhadra Loka means the people who thought that they were rejecting the traditional Vedic system and rejecting the Vedic literatures and rejecting religion to a large extent. Of course, there were many outgrowths of that, such as the Brahmo Samaj, which are basically atheistic, and also the Arya Samaj. But the Brahmo Samaj came from Bengal. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, that was the scenario. He was part of that group in the beginning. This is really interesting, where things are getting better. And even when I was young, I remember going to the New York World's Fair in 1964, before any of you were born. And it was like, you had all these different big companies, like General Motors and General Electric, presenting a bright new world, a bright future, where cars would go automatically, nobody would crash. People would fly through the sky. You'd be able to see people on your phone from somewhere else in the world. Of course, we can do that now, but they didn't take into account how we're destroying the environment, how we're destroying, you know, ethics and culture and everything like that in the process, and how in America we have more psychologists and psychiatrists than the rest of the world combined, and more lawyers, too, than the rest of the world combined. Anyway, so there was that mood around Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time in the 1800s of how everything is getting better in this material world. However, we see now it's not like that. That actually the original system that, you know, Krishna had, Krishna recommend, which is the Varnashram system, which is the agriculturally based system, even though to our Western mind, you know, we want to reject it because it's a very hierarchical system. Hierarchical, not in a bad sense, because at the top of the hierarchy, there were the brahmanas who really cared for everybody. That's why they were brahmanas. That's why they were at the top. You know, the modern society, if you have a hierarchy, you have people who exploit, you know, the business people, the vaishyas, who don't really give a damn, who just want to make a profit and pollute the environment, produce products with that disintegrate as soon as possible. So you have to buy new products or change the style of the product. So really, it's an exploit. When you put the vaishyas in charge of society, it becomes an exploitative society, isn't it? When the brahmin is in charge of society, it's compassionate, love, and all that other stuff. So anyway, so our Western mind sort of rejects a hierarchical society. You know, where men are men and women are women. I mean, and the roles were very clearly defined, because in the farm situation, that the men would go out farming, and the children, they would have a lot of children to protect, and the women, when they had a lot of children, means they became mothers. That's a strange thing. Mother. Nowadays it's considered, if you call someone mother, you know, whack! I'm a Prabhu! Or a Prabhi. Or a... Anyway, but in the old days, the old, good old days, in the Vedic times, because you won't remember that, I do. So, you know, it was like that. It was just, I mean, it's nice. I mean, there was a lady taking care of the kids. It was very nurturing. And the man was like Tarzan. No, the man was going out and earning a living, you know, farming the fields. And it was, the children were assets. They weren't expensive hobbies. Right? And so you got a different scenario. The point I'm making is a different scenario. So the injunctions that applied in that scenario don't necessarily apply in this scenario now that we're in, because we're in a different scenario. Although ultimately Prabhupada did want us to morph or go into that Varnashram scenario, and it may happen in the future due to, you know, natural disasters, lack of natural resources. I don't know how it will happen, because right now I don't see it happening in the West, because Western people don't want to go back to the farm, and even in India people are moving in droves to the cities. And I don't know how India is going to go on without anybody farming in the future. Perhaps they'll have robots like in America. In America we do. We have these tractors that have GPS. And the person just sits there and smokes marijuana, whatever. And the tractor goes and plows the field automatically in the big agribusiness farms. So people are unemployed, basically. And in America, you know, if we want people to work in the fields, we just import them from Mexico or some other country. And in Europe, it's the same thing. They just import them from Poland or whatever, or Russia or whatever. And in India, they're not going to have anyone to import from anywhere else when people don't want to work in the fields. And who are they going to import from? Nepal? China? I don't think it's going to work like that. So, anyway... So in the present situation, we have to have different injunctions in dealing with people. We can't apply. The reason I'm mentioning that is that even though the Vedic injunctions are mentioning certain aspects of society, how to deal with certain people in the hierarchical situation, that may not be applicable right now. So we can't apply Vedic injunctions out of context, even though Vedic injunctions are perfect. However, they're meant for time, place, and circumstance. That's the point I was making by this whole discussion. So, anyway, so these are some of the points we can get. We have about 1.5 minute left for class. Any questions, comments, arguments, problems, issues?
You talk about the Varnashram.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the United States ain't going to give up their democracy to take a monarchy system.
Yeah.
But unless ISKCON itself transforms itself into a Varnashram system, you can't expect anybody outside the society.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. We have to, Prabhupada wanted us to set up model communities so that people could emulate and see simple, like Prabhupada had the motto, simple living, high thinking. That was his motto, you know, the strategic motto for Varnashram. Simple living. Prabhupada didn't like tractors. He didn't. Because tractors mean that the bulls won't be utilized. Prabhupada said if you don't utilize the bulls, then you're going to want to kill them. For example, let's say if you have someone living in the temple and they're just a lazy bum. Of course, you may not want to kill them. But I had one person in the temple when I first started the temple. He was lazy. All he could do is walk to the store and get 7-Up while I was laying bricks. And one day, I didn't kill him. One day, I picked him up by his neck, by his whatever, shirt, and I slapped him. And he said, you slapped me. And I said, damn right. He was the only person I've ever hit in my whole life. Because he was so lazy. But the point, later on I apologized, you know, after going to jail. But, no, I didn't. But the point is, Prabhupada made that point in regard to the bull. If you don't utilize the bull, you're going to want to kill him. Because he's just going to be sitting and eating and getting fat. So, Varnashram is a whole thing, and it has to be done. I don't know how it's going to happen, but it was one of Prabhupada, it's, perhaps Prabhupada said that 50% of his mission was not accomplished because Varnashram was not instituted. And that's part of it. Essential to Varnashram is cow protection and engaging the bull. And that requires a lot of work. It's not that you just like put your key, ignition key in the bull in the morning. Start it up. But you gotta work him every day. That would be nice, you know, you just like. I was plowing with a bull one time and he dragged me all over the field. It requires a lot of energy to deal with a bull.